The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Good day. This is the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. This is Dietrich. We're doing an interview this afternoon with Dr. Matt Raphael Johnson. He's one of the many talented and gracious hosts here at VOR. You can see his work at vornetwork.com along with his own website at russjournal.com. Good deal. So a little bit before the interview, we were talking about his master's thesis, and we got on this subject. He did his master's thesis at the University of Missouri, writing on social alienation and the works of Hegel and Nietzsche. We got on the subject of the Frankfurt School and how these people turned Nietzsche. They put guys like Nietzsche and Freud and Marx at the service of socialism and a popular or a critique of, for instance, in the case of the Frankfurt School, and the critique of normal, sane Western society. And the remark was made that Freud saw himself as the Semitic Hannibal going to conquer the citadels of Rome, which he pictured as the West. He embodied that in his Roman ideal, and that he was the Semitic Hannibal charging across the Alps to take on the West. So it's not just a matter of research or science or study for some of these people. These things are essentially of a political nature. Dr. Johnson, is this essentially an Eastern ideal? I have a hard time finding anything in Western academia that seeks to insert or to politicize research such as this, especially philosophical research. This is exactly what philosophy is supposed to do, is to get rid of ourselves and seek the truth.
Well, that's not going to happen in the 21st century America. Philosophers in the university are a closed caste. They're wildly conformist. I think many of them, I know many of these guys, many of them are incompetent. And outside of their environment, outside of their very closed shop academic environment, they're pretty useless to humanity. And if they weren't being paid out of state money or foundation money, they wouldn't have an impact whatsoever. The basis of their impact is that they have a captive audience every day. But I think something that Freud claimed anyway, to be a scientist with all of this. I have no doubt that what he thought was science was in fact, ideology and power and control. We also mentioned, a few minutes ago that all of the work of the Frankfurt School, who tried to connect Marx and Freud within this Nietzschean context of putting this in your face and taking over, that all of this was financed by the Rockefeller Foundation in America. And, you know, I think there's more to the Hannibal reference than anything else. Remember who Hannibal worked for. Hannibal was connected to the African city of Carthage. Carthage was a Phoenician city that, very much like its namesake in Tyre, in the Levant, was dedicated almost exclusively to trading and money and currency and the banking empire. So I think that there's more to the connection that Freud made of calling himself the Hannibal that was going after the land empire of Rome. I think there's a tremendous amount of symbolism in there. And of course, symbolism was something that people like Carl Jung took very, very seriously. So I think there's a whole, you know, there are many, many layers of ideology and power of what Freud was trying to do. But I think the Hannibal reference is particularly telling in that whose service he was in and why he's become famous at all.
Indeed. Well, we also spoke about, going back to the Frankfurt School, and Freud's intellectual descendants. Herbert Marcuse, these guys in the 1950s and the 1960s were writing things like Eros and Civilization, The One-Dimensional Man, and as you mentioned, these things were done and even acknowledged at the very, you know, in the acknowledgments of these texts, the Rockefeller Foundation. And it kind of reminds me of another book that came out in the 1950s, doing the same thing, The Authoritarian Personality.
Eric Fromm, right.
Yeah, Eric Fromm. And in the acknowledgments, right there on the third page of my copy, it says that the, it's, what is it, the, not the World Jewish Congress, but it's the, it's a Jewish Congress in North America.
That's no surprise. Of course, the authoritarian personality was aimed at Hitler, and this understanding that there are psychological antecedents to somebody not liking the Jews or being somehow a national socialist and everything else. And so if enough of these people get put on the psychiatrist's couch, we can eliminate racism once and for all. Fromm, of course, was from a family of rabbis. And was very much part of the same movement that Marcuse was. But I think the main point is that these people took Nietzsche seriously. And you got to remember, Freud was relatively anti-communist as well. He holds quite vehemently that socialism and equality are impossible. Nietzsche says the same thing, but that didn't bother these guys. I'm not so sure, particularly given the people who finance them, I'm not so sure that equality has ever been an issue, whether Karl Marx or Moses Hess or any of these people in the 19th century, Leon Trotsky on up in the 20th century, equality is not the question. I hold to the view that these guys were more Nietzschean than even we're willing to say, because what Marxism ultimately was, the way it worked out in the Soviet Union, was a major transfer of wealth to the party. And the fact is that overwhelmingly the Communist Party of the USSR was Jewish. That's old news. We all know that. And it seems to me to be all one and the same movement, that the Jewish ethnic mentality is deeply Nietzschean at root. And so maybe this connection isn't as crazy as we think. The fact that Nietzsche throws out a couple of lines that socialism is impossible and people aren't equal, that's not sufficient to eliminate 90% of what he said that at least seemed to serve the interests of these people.
Well, I don't think you can, I agree, Dr. Johnson, and I don't think you can look at a lot of the maneuvers of these political leaders, these political elites, or these intellectual elites, and say, well, these people believe in equality. They were putting the notion of equality at the service of their own ethnic, they were using this to sinew their own ethnic aims.
Exactly. I don't see how anyone can argue with that. The fact is that the party system throughout the Soviet world was incredibly ethnic on the one hand, but on the other hand, incredibly removed from the common population. It had no connections whatsoever with the common people. And you had party members, Jewish party members from Krakow and from Odessa and from St. Petersburg being sent to the collective farms, people who've never seen a farm before, and dictating exactly how production should be developed, who should work here and who should work there. And the only real concern was power, was to make sure that the ethnic party apparatus controlled the agriculture of the people, with the ultimate aim of eliminating it, or putting it differently, mechanizing it. Making sure that agriculture is completely mechanized and therefore no one actually has to work the field. It's not a secret that the Talmud explicitly forbids Jews from engaging in any kind of agricultural work whatsoever. That's for slaves. That's for the goyim. That's been quoted a million times now. But at the same time, both the United States and Canada, whenever these policies of the commissars at the collective farms went sour, which happened all the time, and food shortages were a reality, then the U.S. and Canada would always bail them out with loans, with grants, with shipments of grain. At the center of this was Archer Daniels Midland in Kansas City, who was one of the main architects of all of these grain shipments to the Soviet Union. And I know we've gotten a little bit off topic here, but the fact is that to call the U.S. or the Canadians or Western Europe anti-communist in the Cold War is ridiculous. They supported the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union would never have seen 1925 had not Woodrow Wilson and the Red Cross and a whole bunch of other people got in and supplied the Red Armies with food aid and medical assistance. So, but, you know, it sounds like we're on a different topic, but in reality, it's all one and the same movement and controlled by basically the same bunch of people.
Indeed. I mean, it's, and you get this for people sometimes that, in Archer Daniels Midland, you know, the Rockefeller Foundation. I mean, these are, blue-blooded. These are, sovereign wealth. You know, these groups summon these notions of sovereign wealth. And, you know, what do they have to do with, setting up communism? What do they have to do? What is their interest in seeing communism? You know, and it's kind of like asking the same question. What do ethnic or highly, ethnically conscious Jews, what interest do they have in setting up a state that says, well, everyone is equal and, you know, there's no such thing as race and so on, so on, so forth. It's the same reason any business seeks to eliminate its competition.
Exactly right. And you can control the economy from one place. So ultimately, the aim of global banking oligarchy, whether you be Rockefeller or whatever, is the Soviet-style system where currency and economic decisions and production decisions are all made from one single bureaucracy, very closely controlled by the party or by the elites. You know, when I was in college, I'm embarrassed to say, in the early 90s, I was a conservative. I'm very embarrassed to say that today because conservatives are the single stupidest group of people in America. And I grew up in college with this notion that conservatives, that big money was basically conservative, that big money, was really the main promoter of the Nietzschean idea, the Ayn Randian idea, and Rand, of course, also claimed to have come from Nietzsche on a regular basis. And then only really in grad school. In fact, it was only when I read E. Michael Jones for the first time, maybe in 95, that I began to realize slowly but surely that the elite in Western societies have financed every single leftist and Marxist movement in Western Europe and the Americas. And it completely destroyed my conservative background. And I couldn't call myself a conservative anymore because I noticed that the Rush Limbaughs of the world did nothing but defend these major corporate conglomerates, the same corporate conglomerates that have financed the NAACP, NOW, National Council of La Raza, you know, the whole list.
Oh, sure.
I mean, financed by these same people.
Sure, the GOP gave millions to La Raza, and it's only been a number of months since that happened, or maybe it was sometime last year, but I mean, it's been less than a year that this one instance that I found out about, they legitimize La Raza, which for you non-Spanish speakers means the race, yes, the race, and they mean their race when they say the race, La Raza, and they legitimize them by having, you know, homosexual Jew Ken Melman, the GOP head at the time, go speak to them and, you know, give you the money. The mainstream press covers them as if they're some, you know, legitimate organization that's not racial at all. Not racial at all. But why do you think these big, these blue bloods, why do you think that they're essentially socialists? Is it just that they're that they seek the power and they're using socialism as a way to motivate the masses, or is this high tech slumming? You know, what is it? Is it they just want the choke points? They don't trust individuals making individual free economic decisions. What is it?
Let me run something by you. My father and I took a cruise in the Caribbean back in the early 90s. I can't remember when exactly. And one of the employees who became a friend of ours over that 2-week period told us that when he first started 10 years ago, so that would have been in the early 80s, they were mostly Western European employees at every level, everything from the guys in the engine room all the way to the captain. But in the mid-80s, a lot of the major cruise lines, Carnival and the rest of them, began to suffer from very serious labor problems. They wanted better benefits, they wanted more time on shore, and everything else. And within 18 months, so, you know, within 18 months, 2 years after these labor problems became a major issue and were in the newspapers, the major cruise lines imported almost all of their labor on an affirmative action basis from every continent on the globe. So you'd have someone from Indonesia, someone from the Philippines, someone from Brazil, someone from French Canada, someone from Alaska, an Indian from North Dakota, and a Japanese guy. The point of it was that the only way we could really deal with this labor problem is make sure that there's no solidarity. We're going to make certain that these people are speaking all kinds of different languages. They have all kinds of different biases. They really have nothing to do with each other. And if one group will get too uppity, we'll just mobilize another group against them. And that taught me a lesson. It taught me a lesson that I still think about a lot today. That has everything to do with illegal immigration, the support of La Raza, the support of all of these left-wing organizations, that the one thing that the ruling class fears more than anything else is solidarity. Solidarity based on race or ethnicity or religion or tradition or locality. This is why IBM and the big computer companies transfer their big executives every few years from one city to another. You can't allow any of these guys to build ties with these communities. If they build ties to these communities, they are willing to rebel and to defend them. These kind of solidarity, whatever they're based on, religion or race, these kind of solidarities are the foundation stones for serious rebellion and for serious organizations. If you have a bunch of people on the factory floor or on a cruise ship or anywhere else speaking a million different languages, doing their own thing, they are very easy to manipulate and control. And I think that that has everything to do with the Rockefeller Foundation's particular interest. And that's also at the very basis of the early 90s, mid-90s, E. Michael Jones's research in books like Libido Dominandi and Cardinal Krull and the Culture War and all these other things. The point was that by destroying solidarity, whether urban or rural or anything else, you can more easily control the population. And there's no question in my mind that that's the case.
So they want to leave the proles with no vector of loyalty other than from themselves to the company or to the organization, and no horizontal vectors, no horizontal ties, no bases upon which to organize and agitate for better conditions or anything that might affect the bottom line.
You're exactly correct. And I see this not merely with racial and ethnic issues, but with sexual issues as well. I was having a debate with an old friend of mine from grad school, a feminist of some psychotic variety, who my thesis was that feminism was developed by the Ford Foundation in the early 1970s because American labor and American wages and benefits were very, very high relative to the developing world. And to flood the market with millions, if not tens of millions, of new workers, females, particularly white females with decent education, was precisely the way to break unionization and to lower wages and lower benefits. It's not an accident that feminism hits big in the early 1970s, which is exactly the time at the very highest rate of pay for the American industrial worker up until that point. And from 1974 onward, the average wage in real terms goes down. That's not an accident when you flood right. The market with women. And then, of course, at the same time, the immigration alteration of the law in 1964 and Ted Kennedy also let in a whole bunch of millions more laborers who were willing to work for far less. Without seeing the economic basis for any of I know it's prosaic. But without seeing the economic basis for any of this, nothing makes any sense. And in very simple terms, that's what's in it for the regime and for the wealthy people who control it. And that's why they love to play the conservative game, but they give their money to left-wing, if not openly Marxist causes.
Yes, it always struck me how you mentioned figures like Rush Limbaugh, who's a very popular figure, mainline conservatives on the street, people you'll meet in restaurants or on the street or where in public will know who he is, will like him, will probably have listened to him at one point or another, and it always struck me how politically correct even these people are who say. Or you even profess, they make fun of political correctness or whatever, and yet they're still very, very politically correct. I mean, what is the hold? Is political correctness the mechanism that keeps, for instance, the workers on your cruise ship from speaking up and saying, well, wait a minute, we don't want to be speaking 200 languages here. We want some kind of solidarity or camaraderie. We want these horizontal connections so that we can have some basis upon which to organize. Is political correctness then the mechanism or a mechanism that prevents that?
Yeah, it's a very powerful mechanism, and you'll notice that when the neoconservative and neoliberal will get up and debate issues of any kind, they have the exact same goals. What they differ on is how we will go about reaching these goals. So, for example, concerning Afghanistan, just prior to and immediately after 9/11, both neoconservatives and neoliberals condemned openly the Islamic rule of whether it be the Taliban in Afghanistan or the Shiite state in Iran. Now, the neocons said, and George Bush was very clear on this, that the way to bring women's rights and feminism and abortion, as his wife was later to say, is to use military force. And then on the rubble, we can go in and recreate that society. And it's true that at least some neoliberals opposed the use of force and said that other means like sanctions, like propaganda, like George Soros's Voice of America and these other institutions, we can use that. Maybe even free trade to break down these kind of barriers. So there you have a fairly simple example where neoliberals and neoconservatives had the exact same goal, to take two countries, Iran and Afghanistan, and turn them into versions of New Jersey. But how you do that, whether you use bombs or whether you use the New York Times, that's how they differ. But the agenda is always going to be the same.
Or MTV, they love those satellite dishes sticking out of every window.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, that's part of the problem they have with Iran, is it not? That Iran does have some protection against that. Iran does have laws that they've erected to keep some of this, what they consider degenerate Western media. And I would tend to agree with that, but to keep that stuff out.
Yeah, it's really hard to have a debate over whether or not it's degenerate. I remember in 2000 or 2001, in one of the major assaults on the Gaza Strip that the Israeli state engaged in. In fact, it was right after 9/11, where all eyes were on America and Afghanistan, and therefore we didn't have to worry that much about Israel. That the Israeli state began beaming pornography into both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. In fact, they were beaming pornography on all available TV stations for the Palestinian population. And I remember Jones and I having a conversation. He said, well, what could their motivation be here if not to keep these men home in front of the television rather than out throwing rocks at the Israeli settlers? The fact is that the Israelis were beaming pornography right at the beginning of the major assault on the Gaza Strip, right after 9/11 2001, precisely to weaken the society, to have people become addicted to that crap, and to cease fighting the occupation forces. So it's not just degenerate and immoral, and it'll turn your brain to mush. It is all that stuff, but it's a deeply political way that the West attempts to control these kind of people. And you're absolutely right. The Iranians, after 1979, made certain in public, and was very popular, that the West doesn't need to control us with guns and ships. They also use television They use the female body. They use advertising. They use everything to keep our men away from their duty and doing all kinds of other things. So you're absolutely right about that. And the Iranians have gone out of their way to make certain that Western media may not have anything to do with their society.
Okay, well, thank you. This is the end of the first segment with Dr. Matt Johnson, and we're going to be back, and we're going to get into more of the contemporary issue of Iran and just what's going on over there, and we're going to have some perspective on what's going on. Thank you, Dr. Johnson, and we will be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Dietrich on the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Once again, we are here with Dr. Matthew Johnson, and we're speaking on political correctness, the Frankfurt School, Freud, and now we've moved on to contemporary happenings in Iran, this so-called revolution, I think is what it might be best called. Dr. Johnson has some articles coming out later in the week in the American Free Press on this issue, and I'd like to go ahead and pick his brain on what's going on over there and get his take. Dr. Johnson, aren't we just trying to embarrass the regime with all of this coverage and statements by the press, the president? Aren't we just trying to embarrass the Iranian regime much the same way Muslim countries were playing up the protest in the West in the lead up to the Iraq 2003? Or is there something more to this?
I don't think there's anything more. I don't know how a country and its media, who has been condemning Iran on a minutely basis since 1979, could hope to be a neutral actor in dealing with this election. The major media in Great Britain and in the U.S., although not elsewhere, which is a significant issue, but the major media in Britain and the U.S., are using the exact same rhetoric. And when I say that, I mean that literally. The same phraseology, the same particular tone that they used in 2004 concerning the Ukrainian election. They have done the same thing in Georgia, in Uzbekistan, in Kazakhstan. They've done it every time an anti-Western or relatively anti-Western, which is another way of saying a nationalist, traditionalist sort of candidate, wins an election in a strategic country. They did the same thing in Serbia, also in when the Radical Party began to win elections substantially throughout the country, even in Little Montenegro, when the EU wanted them to declare independence from Serbia. They had elections every week until they got the result that they wanted. And they got 50.0001% saying, yes, we're going to leave Serbia after the 14th election, and then Montenegro is now independent. This is a long-standing scam of the U.S. government. The U.S. government doesn't have the cash. It doesn't have the public support to simply nuke these areas, to go in and attack them with military forces. There's no way this could happen. And so this is the wag the dog. This is the second tier method of destabilizing the societies. The CIA has been involved in Iran since the 1950s, if not before. MI6 has been involved in Iran around the same time. Mossad is deep into the Iranian opposition. This is being orchestrated. There is the Russian press, Ukrainian press, Belarusian press, the German press. They're all saying the same thing. No one outside of America believes that this is anything other than an arranged series of demonstrations overwhelmingly coming from one demographic, the urban wealthy elite of places like Tehran. The reality is that American polling institutions were calling for an Ahmadinejad victory of 60% 2 months ago.
This is pretty much nails it, right?
Yeah. They were calling this 2 months ago. The Russian press was saying the same thing. Their polling agencies, which are much closer than the American polling agencies, were basically saying that Ahmadinejad is roughly floating around 60%. This is an absolute travesty. But the fact is, there is no way that the United States can afford serious military action against this country. And so I have an article coming out in the American Free Press. Of course, I used to work there. I still work there part-time. I'm very close to that bunch down there. They're good friends of mine. I have a regular column down there, irregular, I should say, an irregular column I have down there on these issues. I think one of the real reasons that this tactic has been used rather than the military tactic is that the Russians very clearly warned the United States that they will not take military action against the Iranians, and even more, that the Russians are going to now be, and this actually was done a few years ago, that the Russians will be in charge of building the nuclear power plants in Iran. And so the Russian warning, I think, kind of freaked out the U.S., freaked out the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the State Department, everybody else who matters. And that's why they've gone this second tier route. But I'm not sure what could come out of this. Ahmadinejad has maintained a high level of popularity. Iran is the 18th most powerful economy in the world. She is developing first world infrastructure, a first world healthcare system, no different than Iraq under Saddam Hussein. There's a high level of female education and female literacy, et cetera, et cetera. The man's a popular guy. He would have no motive to rig an election. That's the bottom line.
Well, Dr. Johnson, who is Ahmadinejad? I mean, who is this guy? If we had him in the room here this afternoon, I mean, who is he? Is he the horned megalomaniac? Is he this psychopathic anti-Semitic killer? Who is he? What is he? What type of guy is he? Because it's my understanding of this guy, I'm trying to stay out of the way of the interview here, but I would really like your take on this in light of what my take is, and that is that Ahmadinejad, if my memory serves me, has a doctorate in civil engineering.
He's very well educated. Yes.
Okay, so I know you have your PhD, and I've done my. I've put in my years on college campuses, so I know some civil engineers. Didn't party with a lot of them.
Right, yeah, they're not allowed to do that.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. I mean, civil engineers are just kind of a nerdy, I don't want to say stick in the mud, but they're not exactly your rubbing your hands together and cackling type bad guys.
Well, that's an interesting take. I never really thought of his education in this respect. But it shows you that he does have a strong interest in science and the scientific technique, but without ever leaving the basic traditional Islamic point of view. And that's impressive right in and of itself. My impression over the last few years, and my understanding of Iran really derives from my understanding of Russia's interaction with Iran, which has actually been substantial, so it does matter there. He's an immensely mild-mannered individual. He hates attention. He, in fact, it wasn't that long ago where he canceled rallies because they were too large. He canceled a rally at the very beginning of the presidential campaign last year because it was going to be too big. The cops were saying that there's going to be a million people here. We don't know if we can, you know, really police this place properly. And Ahmadinejad said, you know what, there might be a stampede. We can't have this. You know, this is going to be bigger than the Super Bowl. Forget it. You know, I have better things to do. So we canceled it. So, you know, that should give you some mentality. He comes from peasants. He comes from a rural area. He does not come from money. He doesn't come from the elite. So one of the reasons, you know, it's the same thing in Belarus with Lukashenko. They have a very similar demographic. Their support does not come from the cities, generally speaking. Their support comes from the poor, from rural areas, from traditional areas, from the churches and the armed forces, from the older generation. You see this with a lot of populist leaders. The one group of people who they alienate are that, like, you know, 20-something wannabe yuppie in the city. And that's exactly the bunch in Iran or in Belarus or even places like Ukraine that they speak English, they're well-educated, a lot of them would like to emigrate. A lot of them aren't particularly Islamic. They wouldn't mind a little pornography now and again or a little bit of Jack Daniels now and again. That's exactly the demographic that I'm seeing in all these videos that's taken to the streets in Iran, and you know, I've been out there now for a very long time. Ahmadinejad is somebody who has made certain that his primary interest in domestic politics concerns the state of the poor and the state of the economy relative to the poorest and most vulnerable of the Iranian civilians. You see the same thing in Venezuela with Chavez. This kind of nationalist populist approach, and those two things have to be in combination, you see with a lot of these guys, Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan there too, these are the guys that have to go. And just as an aside, it's funny that the one place that Jews for the most part are not entirely opposed to the government are the Jews living in Iran. There's not that many of them, but those that are there generally support the system as it stands.
That fascinates me, Dr. In my perception as well. I mean, for instance, when you get this vile propaganda that comes out every now and then that just somehow bubbles up through the mainstream and makes it onto the major papers here, at least in the U.S. For instance, the silliness last year that came out that the Iranian parliament passed a decree saying that Jews were going to have to wear yellow stars. Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
And then some of the loudest people to speak up were Iranian Jews.
Exactly. Well, for one thing...
No, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, Iranian Jews are actually Semites, unlike most of the Jews of the world. Iranian Jews generally are anti-Zionist. They view it as kind of a Khazar colony, having nothing to do with them or their interests. Semitic Jews are very successful there. They fit in very well with that society without having really a big negative impact on it. And they're generally anti-Zionist. So the Iranian government has absolutely no problem with them. And I think you're absolutely right. The purpose of planting that ridiculous story was, if nothing else, to frighten Jews actually living in Iran, by the way, many of whom do speak English, most European languages, because they're very cosmopolitan in their banking, etc., to frighten them into possibly supporting an opposition figure. But in the current Iranian case, Mousawi is deeply CIA, and as I've written, and you know, I've been talking about this all over town over the last couple of days, and now it's cropping up everywhere. And it kind of irritates me because this happens quite a bit. But Mousawi was deeply involved with Iran-Contra. Yeah, I think
he's
by now
he's a figure of the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s. Well, what was his role? How does he pop up there?
He was a relatively minor figure, but apparently, well, remember, he was vice president at one time. He was, he's always been a major figure, but he was somebody who was a middleman, a relatively minor middleman, as far as the Iranian government was concerned, relative to the war with Iraq. He was sort of your second or third tier person to go to if something was to go wrong with the cachet drops. Now, I quoted something directly from the official Iran-Contra report that mentions Mousavi with this understanding that if something was to go wrong, if this was to be intercepted, if the Soviets had something to say about it, you know, something like that, Mousavi was the guy that the CIA was to contact to smooth the transaction. So put it this way, he was a background figure there to fix something if something went wrong. Now, this is in the official Iran-Contra report put out jointly by the Congress and by the special prosecutor. So the guy is a major world player. But everyone knows, and no one would deny, that the CIA was deeply involved with this arms transfer. This is part of their job, both in Central America and in Central Asia. And as a result, there's no doubt that Mousavi was considered, at least back then, as an asset of the CIA. And so it's no surprise that this man now has become the lightning rod for this movement. It's the same thing in 2004 in Ukraine, where the main figure that the CIA put its money on in the Ukrainian election was somebody who was deeply involved in investments in Western banking institutions. So the point is that the CIA and kindred groups in the West like to work with people who they know, work with people who have a history with them. And so Mousavi, he fits the bill perfectly. And that's really all the evidence that anyone needs. He fits the perfect MO of CIA scams like this, in the past. He's the perfect patsy for these guys. It should be noted that, his presidential campaign has as one of its, planks in its platform that we are, as Iranians, going to ban Holocaust denial in Iran. So that should tell you a little bit of something about how relevant he is to the average Iranian person.
And it must be noted that Iranians don't really have they don't really have a stake in the Holocaust, at least to themselves. They don't feel that they have any stake in it. This is for
putting it mildly.
This is for foreign consumption.
Exactly. And it just shows you
that it'll be that they don't want Holocaust denial.
Right. And you see, again, the Ukrainian example is a perfect example. The Ukrainian presidential campaign of Yushchenko in 2004, it was all in English. You know, their main website of the Yushchenko campaign in 2004 was in English. Now, I'm seeing signs out in the streets of Iran. Every single one of them is written in English. This guy has a Facebook group. Everything is being done in the English language. Yeah, this is supposed to be an Iranian presidential election, and almost all the election stuff that I'm seeing from this guy, he's on Twitter, he's on every social networking thing, stuff I've never even heard of before. Everything's being done in English, pictures of him going off the diving board. You know, it's like the Americans put this entire thing together.
Right,
It's ridiculous.
It's almost embarrassing.
It really is.
It's playing out like these other color revolutions. It's this postmodern, made for TV, made for internet. Dr. Johnson, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there were reports going out last week that Twitter, and this is from Twitter itself. This was substantiated by the chairperson at Twitter that they were asked not to do some regularly scheduled maintenance on their physical infrastructure, their servers and whatnot. They were asked to delay that, to put that off, to not do it because Twitter was so central to whatever it is they were trying to do in the meddling with the Iranian internal politics using this service.
You know, I heard about that. I did. Yahoo had published it, and I didn't read it, but I saw the headline saying that the Iranian government was actually taking action against the social networking groups headquartered in the United States, and that the U.S. government was putting pressure both in on Iran and on the on Facebook and Twitter itself to keep up to not listen to the Iranians, to not do anything like this. And I know Michael Hoffman has a piece up, and I really appreciate him as I always. The West is attempting to ban discussion on these topics on the internet, shutting down websites and blogs. They're self-righteously going out there saying we have to have internet freedom in Iran. It's the classic nonsense coming straight from, really, it's now a complex, and I learned so much about this in the Ukrainian election, which is why I keep going back to it, because it's the exact same script that George Soros, when he bought Voice of America, when he bought Voice of America, I think in 2000 or 99, he bought it from the CIA, but he maintained the same CIA infrastructure. So when you talk about media, you know, getting beamed into these places, you're talking about a Soros CIA complex. So now you have big money, Zionism, and the CIA working really out of the same office as far as Voice of America and, you know, 1,001 other offshoots of Voice of America that George Soros has financed. So, but like I said before, I think that it was Russian pressure that forced this from the Americans. I don't think that, Obama has the stomach for a war over there. The Russians said that the war is going to be an awful big one if you move into Iranian territory. There's so many Russians there. There's a lot of Russians in Tehran. The Russians have a large scientific establishment in the major cities, and there's a substantial Russian minority in the country. Therefore, an airstrike on Tehran would mean the deaths of some fairly elite Russian scientists, which is quite a complication as far as U.S. foreign policy is concerned. And I think it became very clear that another tactic was necessary. So they took the script from Serbia, from Georgia and Ukraine, and now applied it to Iran. And I just don't see what can come out of this, because any kind of a vote recount is going to come up with the same thing. So I'm not sure, unless the West is just going to demand that these people shred ballots, how is this going to work in their interest? It's still
I'm not even sure they could shred that many ballots. I mean, it wasn't even close, as you mentioned earlier. We're talking 60, 63 and a few points percent. I mean, normally when you see stolen elections, you don't have something like this. I mean, this is this was not a close election, in other words.
No, that's right. And the press, throughout the world, including in the United States, had this election decided months ago. Now, as far as the Russian case is concerned, when Dmitry Medvedev became Putin's successor, the U.S. wouldn't even get involved. They said, this guy is too popular, Putin is too popular, there's no way we can create a candidate to go against him. So they spent no money. And so the Russian election was really ridiculous, because whoever Putin said was going to win was definitely going to win. He's too popular. He could have said that I'm going to win and I would be president right now. So he could have said anything he wanted. The U.S. is if they tried now a place where this, there's two places where this failed particularly badly. The first was in Belarus, where they tried to disrupt the elections 2 years ago. I think they had a rally of 1,000 people, and that's pretty much all that happened. The whole thing fizzled. They tried it in Kazakhstan, I think 2 years ago. That also fizzled. So they've learned a lot from some of those failures, and they've really smoothed out their game quite a bit. So this Iranian scam is really the result of a lot of trial and error over the last 10 years. So this is the best that the CIA can do right now.
I think what they're trying to do is maybe just have another object lesson, another model, another practice round. I don't think anyone in their right mind thinks that, or at least at CIA or at Soros HQ, that they're actually going to get their man in the seat. I think what the best hope right now must be that they're just trying to build some political capital to be spent at some undisclosed time in the future in the American population. You know, so to build this capital within the population here. I mean, because what you're or what I'm seeing out in the street and what I'm reading on the internet and in the blogosphere, you have a lot of liberals, saying, oh, you know, there's this whole movement, oh, we support Iranian freedom or freedom in Iran and all this other stuff. So it's just getting it out onto the street. And then instead of saying, oh, well, a year ago it was, oh my God, you know, Bush wants to bomb Iran now. You know, you've got McCain singing bomb Iran, but now we've got the brown guy in and, everything's touchy feely, but how are we going to, get bellicose towards these people? You know, you need to build up this desire in the population. And I think this stuff is for local consumption, at least for now.
I think you're absolutely correct. I think you have to build the idea that the election was stolen and therefore the government is illegitimate. And if the government is illegitimate, you can do whatever you want to them because they have no right to be there. But they took a risk here. And I was thinking about this the minute that the first street protest occurred. That for years and years, just as a little kid, and the 1979 thing occurred, the slogan was that there is no democracy in Iran, that they have no such thing as elections. Now, they've had to admit that they weren't telling the truth all those years. They do have elections, ferociously contested elections. So that's a risk to some extent. But remember, they're not just building a base in America, and they are doing that. They're also building a movement in Iran that if anything was to happen, remember, this economic crisis has led to substantial increases in prices. It's been the one failing, I think, of the Iranian government over the last decade has been they can't control inflation. Inflation has been, on average, I guess maybe 15%, which is pretty bad. Ahmadinejad has succeeded in bringing it down roughly to about 10% today, which is really good by Iranian standards. But you add this problem of inflation to the problem of the world economic crisis, and you do have people who have a problem with the economy. But to think that they would then say that this must be Ahmadinejad's fault is pretty ridiculous. But so I think that they're trying to build a movement in Iran that they could always use in the future just in case this gambit is to fail. So you're right on both counts.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is they've had this cadre of students and bloggers and people that have made themselves known that they can sort of pull off the shelf in the future.
Exactly. But make certain to realize that this happens in South Korea every weekend.
Right.
I mean, there's riots in South Korea every weekend. Every weekend. I mean, at least 180 times a year, you have major riots in the big cities. And it hasn't affected South Korea becoming a major power. So if the South Koreans can do it, then the Iranians can do it.
Well, Dr. Johnson, our time is up, and I would like to thank you once again for your insight. And once again for your weekly show on the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network that can be heard on Thursdays between 9 and 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. This has been Dietrich, Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, VORnetwork.com. Dare to know. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.